KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, a coalition of elected officials, environmentalists, and developers will be announcing its Grow Smart Bay Area initiative later this week. We'll focus on the vision they have, and we'll hear how these planners hope to accommodate anticipated population growth and to protect the environment. What should the future look like as far as Bay Area neighborhoods are concerned, including the underserved neighborhoods, and how can they best be ensured a sustainable future? Forum is next with the panel and your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. By 2035, population growth is expected to expand in this region by some 7 to 9 million. A coalition of elected officials, environmentalists, and developers has put together a smart growth proposal for the Bay Area that will officially be unveiled on Wednesday. And what's exciting about this, as I told the gentlemen who were with me here in studio this morning, is that, well, it's like the way they do things in the Netherlands, having environmentalists and developers, lion and the lamb, sitting down together, and public officials, and actually planning on smart growth and sustainability. Joining us to talk about this plan, which is going to be unveiled, as I said, on Wednesday, is Jeremy Madsen, who's executive director of the Greenbelt Alliance. And the Greenbelt Alliance has long been working to protect Bay Area open spaces by developing public policy, advocacy, and education. And good morning.
Thank you.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Carl Anthony, founder of Earth House and Breakthrough Communities Initiative. He's co-author with Paloma Pavel of a new book, which will be released soon by MIT Press. Want to give it a plug here. Carl's an old friend. It's called Breakthrough Communities, Sustainability and Justice in the Next American Metropolis. Welcome, Carl Anthony.
Thank you very much.
And Will Fleisig also joins us this morning, president of Communities Development Incorporated. They specialized in mixed-use developments around the nation. Good morning to you.
Nice to be here. Thank you, Michael.
Good to have you. Also want to welcome Ken Kirky, planning director for ABAG, the Association of Bay Area Governments. Good morning.
Thank you, Michael. Happy to be here.
Glad to have you all here. And let's begin, Jeremy Madsen, with you so we can get kind of an overview of this. This is all an initiative, as I said, that will be revealed on Wednesday, and it's for the next generation of growth. And I guess the message is that generation of growth can be accommodated.
That's right. What we did is a couple years ago, we stepped back and said, as this region grows from, as you said, from 7 million people to 9 million people by 2035, and we're also going to add about 1.7 million new jobs in the region over that period of time. And we asked the question, where could that go? And what would it mean for our communities, our economy, and our environment? And so we basically did a study, and that study reveals that we can accommodate that next generation of growth within our existing cities and towns of the Bay Area through infill development. What that ends up meaning for our region, I think, is really quite exciting. It means that we have the opportunity to take communities where we've seen disinvestment and where the best times appear to have passed and make them better places. It gives us the opportunity to really create climate-friendly communities, and it gives us the opportunity to protect this really amazing open space that is so much a part of the identity of our region. So I think what we see here is an opportunity to turn the Bay Area into a model metropolis so that, you know, in 30 years when we do this show, you don't introduce it as this is what they do in the Netherlands. It's introduced as this is what they do in the San Francisco Bay Area.
So very exciting, and certainly the potential is here. But how much can you really factor in this rather fragile economy that we have now?
Well, I think what we're looking at, like I said, this is the next generation of growth. And so to some degree, we're not looking at what just happens here in the next couple of years. It's what happens in the next 30 years. That said, I think this situation with the economy is really forcing us to look at how do we do things differently and what has gone wrong. And where do people want to live and how do they want to live? We see that across America, places that are closer to the urban center have seen property values drop much more slowly than people who are places that are out on the urban edge. We also see that, for example, in terms of transportation, it's much cheaper to live places that are close to transit, where you have the option to ride the bus or ride the train versus having to use the car for every trip. It's roughly a third of the transportation costs for a place that is transit accessible versus not. So we very much see this as a pattern of growth for the future that will allow us to live more within our means.
I know you're trying to enlist citizens and get real strong public support for this. And as I said, the developers are really involved in this, working with them to increase market demand for smart growth and infill. But where does this vision move into action? I mean, who gets the report, first of all, and how does it start being implemented?
Well, I think the group who's going to get the report are basically the people who you mentioned. So developers, elected officials, the environmental community, the community development, people who work on community development, and a myriad of others. And what we have to do is, I think, band together as people who all care about this region, the main business leaders of this region as well, and really identify what are the policies that need to be put in place in order to make it happen. What are the funding mechanisms? Something I know Ken Kirky across the way cares an awful lot about and thinks an awful lot about. And then what do we need to do in order to engage citizens in planning and thinking about their communities so that as we grow and we actually have people thinking, this is the development that I want for my neighborhood because it's going to bring the shops, the parks, the amenities that will make this place a better place.
The infrastructure is very important to this, obviously. In fact, could you talk about the smart spots briefly? You've got, what, six, seven smart spots?
Yeah. So in our report, which, as you said, is going to be released on Wednesday, we identified what are called seven smart spots around the region. These are places that are, you know, for the most part, they're multi-city areas. So Southern Alameda County, Union City, Hayward, Fremont. And in these places, we've identified that there is enough room for roughly 80% of the growth of the Bay Area. And then the other 20% can be accommodated through infill development in communities outside those smart spots. And again, you know, these are places where we have underutilized transit corridors, where we have downtowns that have struggled as we've seen development pushed to the urban edge. And reinvestment in these places and doing reinvestment in a way that truly engages the residents who are already there is the opportunity to create better neighborhoods.
Jeremy Madsen, again, is Executive Director of Greenbelt Alliance. Carl Anthony is also with us, founder of Earth House. And Carl, you're going to really have a lot of the underserved or so-called undesirable neighborhoods right at the center of this whole plan, at least from what I've seen. And there are threats and opportunities, especially for inner-city residents, where much of this development will take place. How do you see this in terms of opportunity?
Well, Mike, this is we're at a really important historic moment now, and we do have a chance to do it right, but we also have a chance to mess up. And what we've looked at is over the last 60 years, since the National Highways Act and urban renewal,
there a lot was of messing up there.
Yeah, it was really a lot of messing up, and people who lived in the inner cities got kind of rolled over, and their neighborhoods got destroyed. And we are facing a crisis in these neighborhoods now, and this represents both a really major threat, but it also represents a major opportunity, and I'm hoping we can pull it off.
What are you hoping can be pulled off here? I mean, right from the top.
Well, I think, first of all, we really need to strengthen citizen engagement in this process. As you know, the demographics in the Bay Area and California have been changing very rapidly. Over 50% of the population today in the Bay Area are people of color. And I've been around to a lot of these sort of planning sessions for sustainable communities, and very few people of color participate in this. And so we have an opportunity now to sort of engage people from these communities in the forefront of helping to shape this this new generation of urban infill. People of color, working class communities, the labor movement, all of these folks are now sort of waking up to the potential opportunity, but also they understand that we have to make a big shift in California and the world, in the nation, around issues like climate change. And at the moment when the economy is under enormous stress and meltdown, we see this as a potential for helping us to find a pathway out.
Is there a pathway in terms of bringing more of these people into the process?
There are. In fact, we, as you mentioned before, Dr. Prevail and I are just coming out with a book from MIT Press called Breakthrough Communities, Sustainability and Justice in the Next American Metropolis. And we've been working with people all over the country from communities of color and working class communities, and they're beginning to see that there really is a silver lining in this process, that being engaged in helping to support and bring into being the next generation of sustainable communities is really potentially a ticket to solving a lot of unresolved questions from the past.
And connecting sustainability to justice or
equity.
Exactly,
making that really at the center of the process.
Again, Carl Anthony is founder of Earth House. It's a Breakthrough Communities initiative and co-author with Paloma Pavel of the new book, Breakthrough Communities, Sustainability and Justice in the Next American Metropolis. Where does housing figure into all this?
Pardon me?
Where does housing figure into all this?
I'm sorry?
New housing.
Where's
affordable housing?
Yeah, well, actually, I mean, we have the issue is that, that we need to really move toward mixed income communities. And basically, this represents a major shift in our development patterns from over the last couple of generations, where we've been building economically segregated and racially segregated communities. We now have a chance to really shift the pattern, which it turns out to be economically much more viable to have mixed income communities that bring together folks who are at the high end of the spectrum with folks who are really at the lower ends. And this means potential for better schools, increasing the tax base of various communities, increasing services for these communities. So bringing mixed income housing is really quite central to this. And we have to do it really well, because there is a threat of gentrification and displacement that is happening in many of these places. And under a traditional pattern, when the folks who've abandoned these communities start to come back, they really create pressures on the housing market, and the housing prices go up. The people who are most vulnerable, of course, are the renters. People who own property will stand to benefit quite a bit from this new investment. But the folks who are renters need special protections.
I'm going to bring Ken Kirky into this discussion. He's planning director for ABAG, the Association of Bay Area Governments. And I should mention that the Bay Area development in general has been affected and will be affected by Senate Bill 375, which we spoke about here on Forum. It requires the Air Resources Board to set, greenhouse gas reduction targets in each region of the state. That's between the years 2020 and 2035, and provide incentives for essentially valuable and sustainable communities, and revitalizing those communities, and also linking regional planning efforts for transportation and housing. And the reason I mention all this, 375, Ken, is because ABAG, along with Metropolitan Transit, is responsible, really, for implementation.
Yes, we are. It's going to be a big task, and I think one can delve into 375 and get into some pretty arcane legislative sort of talk, which is not too interesting to most citizens and probably not to your listeners either. But I think it's important to think about 375 from the perspective of what it can do to serve as a tool relative to some of the things that Jeremy and Carl have already touched on. Folks in the Bay Area care, generally speaking, a lot about climate change. In the 3+ years I've been with the association, I've seen a real shift when going out and speaking to different audiences about growth, in part because of the context of climate change, and people understand that the kind of drive till you qualify sprawl pattern that the region has had isn't actually too smart for a region that thinks of itself as being a very smart place, that it makes sense to redirect growth. We have a framework in place, a policy framework, something called the Focus Initiative, priority development areas, which are largely the smart spots that Jeremy touched on earlier. These are areas that are infill areas, transit served, they can accommodate more development. But it's going to take resources to do so. It's going to take resources to do the kind of planning that Carl touched on, really neighborhood level planning that gets us away from a project by project approach to transit oriented development, which is sort of what we've had in the past. I think most folks can recognize
proactive neighborhood planning.
Proactive neighborhood planning that really gets down to the community level, so that the folks who've lived in those neighborhoods for a long time, whether they be a more distressed neighborhood economically or a more affluent neighborhood, that they can actually get a hold of the plan, be a part of the planning process, and support it as it moves forward. That itself takes some resources, particularly in the more fiscally distressed communities. The other piece that takes money is capital infrastructure funding. If we're going to have humane, walkable, mixed-use neighborhoods, those communities in our region that haven't seen a lot of development for a long time, some of the underserved urban communities, projects are not going to pencil out on their own in those communities. And if the region wants to continue to preserve its green belt, to get growth in the right places, to revitalize our neighborhoods, we really do have to think about getting resources to these communities to build them as places and not just talk about density and numbers. And
well, Carl said you're the guy to talk to about funding mechanisms.
That's because I talk about it all day long. But, you know, I think there are folks who are working on this issue, trying to come up with some different funding solutions for the region. And it's tough. The way that California finances much of anything, one might argue, is not working so well.
I think that's an understatement.
I think it probably is an understatement. We do like to think, though, that the Bay Area is a pretty smart place as a region, and that this region might be able to come up with some regional-level funding solutions that will work so that this region can grow the way it really wants to moving forward.
Well, I mentioned 375 assigning responsibilities not only to ABAG, organization that you're associated with, but also to MTC, the Metropolitan Transportation. They have their own idea about smart growth, their own vision, don't they?
We actually work very closely together now. The focus program that I described earlier is a joint agency program. We are working together and will be on SB 375.
So there's no real conflict or tension between?
No, I don't believe there is.
Yeah. As far as you're concerned, people can be brought in, as Carl suggested, and the citizens can be galvanized and really activated on this.
We think
they need to be. Obviously.
We think they have to be. And let's be honest, it's a big job. This is a region of nearly 7.5 million people at this point, 110 jurisdictions, 26 transit agencies, et cetera, et cetera. A civic engagement process in a region that's really the size of a state is not a small task, and yet it's the task before us. And I think when I say before us, you know, speaking about SB 375, yes, ABAG and MTC are ultimately responsible for adopting it, but if it looks like it's ABAG's plan or ABAG's strategy or MTC's or the two agencies, it's not going to fly. It really needs the buy-in of the local jurisdictions, of the development community, of the equity community, and of the people in the region if it's going to be successful.
And actually, I think
Carl Anthony.
Yeah, I think also what's unique about the focus project, I think, is that the cities have actually come forward and actually nominated a number of these sites based upon their knowledge, so that it is it is definitely a regional effort, but it's an effort that it really is coming from the bottom up, so that it does have a good start, a running start to actually mobilizing both the elected officials as well as the citizenry. But I think we do need to, there are examples around the world like Curitiba where people have actually grabbed a hold of this opportunity and really set a pace for a new concept of metropolitan communities. And we here in the Bay Area are well positioned to do that. But I would also urge that particularly the working class communities, unions, and communities of color to work very closely with organizations like the Urban Habitat Program and the ACORN Group and the Genesis Group, which is a church-based organizing group.
I was going to mention religious organizations could really move the grassroots too.
Yeah, exactly, to really get on board to make sure that this plan does what it promises to do, which is to make region better for everybody and not just those who are most wealthy.
Well, let's also talk about this from the developer's standpoint. Will Fleissig's with us. He's president of Communitas Development. They specialize in mixed-use development around the country. First, from your perspective, Will Fleissig, just getting back to what we talked about with Ken Kirky, as well as Carl Anthony, I mean, the fragility of this economy right now. I mean, Vallejo's gone broke, and there's a feeling that maybe the state will go broke. In terms of going to the banks and getting the kind of costs for development, we're in a very precarious situation.
Michael, you sound like a developer. This is great. I'm pleased to hear you raise these issues. First, I want to say thank you to Jeremy and the Greenbelt Alliance for including me and other development groups in this whole effort. I think that's really a very good way to go. And Greenbelt's really been at the forefront of looking at this kind of connection between open space and infill and density and affordability. And you've done just a great job. And I was actually, when I was working with Bridge Housing, we did a project in San Jose where Greenbelt helped the community come to the hearing. And where we had the 400 neighbors, not in my backyard, we got some people to say, I want this project. So I believe in what you're doing, and I'm glad to be here to try and help.
I didn't know you were with Birch Housing. That explains
everything.
I'm
not with Bridge, but we were a partner with Bridge. Yeah. The Martin Group did it.
Well, so if I can just jump in really quick. Thank you for saying that, Will.
Right.
But I think
sure,
the
I
important thing here is that in doing those projects, you were doing the right projects. And sustainability is about not just, as you were just saying, protecting what we already have and protecting the open spaces in our neighborhoods as they are, but also really encouraging developers to do the right kinds of development in the right types of places. And, you know, Will, your type of work is exactly up the alley. So this is a natural partnership between environmental organizations and developers.
But at the risk, again, of sounding like a developer, these are tough times for you guys. Just in terms of all those foreclosures and the banks and –
there's no question. And I think you have to go back to Jeremy's opening point. This is a blueprint for looking forward. And we are going to get out of this situation, and the foreclosures and all that is going to somehow – we will bottom out. Don't ask me when, but it will. And so here's the key. Carl said it just right, that we need to be setting this direction and getting this conversation to start happening at this community level and do it in a way – everybody wants some predictability. Both developers and the community people, and I dare say even some of the government folks want some predictability in terms of revenues. We also look at opportunity, and that's developers, that's what we do. We look at opportunity and we look at risk, and we try and manage that process. And so what this to me is about is saying we can begin to set some direction, set some of the pieces in place, identify where we think these corridors, which is really where it's going to happen along a corridor, can start to make sense, have the community get involved early, not about a project or about what I'm or one of my colleagues is going to build, but what should happen along these sites before there's even a project proposed, because then I can come in and be responsive to those issues. I can go work with the community and say, oh, how about some pocket parks here? How about moving the parking access over this way? How about if we put a training program in the first floor over here? I mean, I think there's a way to get these issues up front. And then it's my job to figure out how do we actually accommodate that, make it work. I have to make a buck, pay the bank back, pay my investors back. But I can then at least have stuff on the table. I know what I'm dealing with. And the problem we've
had – so a good blueprint and public support is really what you're talking about before you set things into motion.
Right, because then if the expectations and the aspirations are put forward, then I can work with the community and say, ah – you want these 10 things, we can do 8 of them. And if the city bellies up and there are a few other foundations can come forward, we might even be able to get all 10. Here's how we can accommodate it. Work with me. Don't just criticize the project at the public hearing in front of the council. We do need to talk about the political realm of this whole thing, Michael.
But, you know, I think it's also really important to point out that this foreclosure crisis is paradoxically a really important opportunity, because we've had a set of arrangements around lending and around financing development, which have not been very sensitive to both the needs of poor people and working people, but also the people who are involved in this are not only the individuals, but also the neighborhoods and communities that are deeply affected by it. And it seems to me that one of the paths into the conversation is how do we structure fair policies around the mortgage lending that actually promotes smart growth.
Let us expand that conversation. In fact, I'm going to invite you, the listeners, to join us with any questions or comments you might have. You're cordially invited to do that now. Our toll-free number is available to you, so please join the conversation. It's 866-733-6786. Toll-free again for your calls, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org. As we talk about Grow Smart Bay Area, the initiative will be unveiled later this week. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about a plan that's being put forward by a coalition of elected officials, environmentalists, and developers. Growth Smart Bay Area, an initiative that will be unveiled later this week on Wednesday, getting a peek of it now, looking at, well, the plan is looking at expected population growth and how to accommodate it in the Bay Area and the expansion, while also protecting and certainly conserving environmental concerns. With us in studio is Ken Kirky, Planning Director of ABAG, the Association of Bay Area Governments, Will Fleisig, who is President of Communitas Development. They specialize in mixed-use developments around the nation. Carl Anthony, who's founder of Earth House, and Jeremy Madsen, Executive Director of Greenbelt Alliance. And by the way, Carl, tell us a little bit about Earth House.
Well, Earth House is an organization. It's about 20 years old. And its mission, we've been focusing a lot on the metropolitan development. And the mission today is to build multicultural and multiracial leadership for sustainable metropolitan communities in California and the nation. And as I said, we're really very pleased to have our book coming out in the next few weeks. It'll be available. And we're also really reaching out to people around the communities, particularly faith-based organizations, as well as unions and other social justice organizations, to get ahead of this curve and build the kind of collaboration that we need in order to make sure that the new growth is fair as well as ecologically sustainable.
Let's bring in our callers, and we'll go right to Jessica in San Francisco. Good morning.
Good morning. Yesterday, I participated in something called Sunday Streets in the Mission District in San Francisco, and the streets were closed off to traffic. It was so wonderful to be in the neighborhood without any cars, and I'm wondering if there's any focus on car-free development in this new plan.
Jeremy Manzin?
Well, I would say what this plan is about is providing a great deal of options, and one of those options is the opportunity for people to be able to live in neighborhoods where they don't have to drive for everything they need to do, where they can walk to the grocery store or walk their kid to the ice cream store or walk to school. And
that's the whole concept of smart growth. Transportation, jobs being close together, and
exactly,
schools and
exactly.
So forth.
And it's
right, but even beyond that, what about a community where the cars actually are not driving right through the community?
I think this is absolutely a potentially important idea. You know, the metropolitan America that we are in today was actually shaped by not only the automobile, but the public investment in freeways and highways. And what's happening now is people are beginning to see that actually there are really very negative aspects. There's some positive aspects to having an automobile, but there are many negative things that we had not learned about. And so this whole idea of pedestrian-friendly places and places that are actually off limits to automobiles or where cars have to be slowed down to meet the scale and the speed of pedestrian movement is really central to the idea of smart growth. And communities, if they get engaged in this process early, can help to shape the kinds of places that you're talking about.
Well, Fleisig, you want to add something here?
Yeah, I think one of the things we need to be careful about is, you know, we talk about sustainability and this kind of grand, you know, big picture. It's a very, very local idea as well. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, we're talking a lot about healthcare costs. We're talking about the costs of transportation, as Jeremy mentioned, education and access to education, job training, all the green jobs that were out there. At the core of this whole plan, as I see it, is the ability to touch on all those kind of, I'll call livability, community benefits. And by tying it back to transit and transit infrastructure, you now are making an investment, a long-term good investment in all these other aspects about our communities. So it goes beyond the point of how do you get from point A to point B.
Well, it also means,
what happens,
for example,
at A and what happens at B.
As you suggest, a better transportation system, better infrastructure for that transportation system, but also more bike routes, for example.
Right. Well, you know, Richard Register, who's been a leader in this field
right.
over a long period of time, has said transportation is what you do when you're not where you want to be. And I think the point that the caller is making about how important it is to make our neighborhoods and the places where we live and work and play places where we want to be, so that we don't have to spend so much time getting in our cars and moving about.
Well, here's a listener from the South Bay who I think is right on point here, at least where transportation is concerned. Good morning, Mike.
Hi, Mike. Hello, everybody. I work in San Jose. I'm in the transportation industry. I've been following ABAG and MTC for the last 10, 15 years. These types of agencies that talk about sustainable development and transportation, it's almost laughable, and it's no offense to anybody. It's just that there's too many competing interests. There's political appointments. Nothing really gets done. Now, your guests talk about local development, everything's local. That's not true. It's really regional, countywide and regional, because you're telling me, for example, if you want to lay down a light rail line or corridor, you're only interested in the local community. That line has to be 8, 10, 15 miles long to be effective. So there goes the argument that everything's local. So that should be something that's looked at. I would like to see MTC, ABAG, and others merged, combined, or eliminated, and create a real effective planning and policy type committee.
Let's hear from Ken Kirky on this, and I thank you for the call, Mike. Ken Kirky?
I think the listener raises a really good point. I'm not going to take on the merger discussion or elimination discussion at this moment, but one of the big challenges we have, and it came up relative to the first caller's comment question, is transit effectiveness. Part of what this is about is making walkable communities places where people can get to the things they need in their neighborhoods, but also having a really effective transit system. And I would argue that the caller's point about the regional nature of transit is true. And we have a challenge in this region with 20-some transit agencies serving the region. I'm not talking necessarily about merging agencies, consolidating agencies, but certainly we need to look at the effectiveness of our transit system and how it serves not just people who have no other options, but how it serves people who do have other options. Because if transit doesn't work, if it's not efficient, if it's not effective for riders, much of the time they're going to get in their cars because they really don't have other choices. And too often in this region, our transit systems are planned on a county-by-county basis. And I think that's one of the tasks we have going forward is to really deal with that issue.
Caller's also raising some questions, of course, about the efficacy of ABAG. And sort of on that note, I'm interested in getting your response to an email here from Lee in Palo Alto, who says, as I understand it, ABAG is pressuring Palo Alto to stuff as many housing units into our town as conceivable with various sanctions if we don't. Apparently, Palo Alto has committed the grave offense of providing more jobs in other communities, and we've also committed the offense of having more parks than any other communities, which could be replaced by low-income housing in ABAG's dream for our town. I suppose my question is, why is Palo Alto being punished for supplying jobs? Instead of forcing us to infill, why not force communities like, say, Atherton to provide more jobs?
Well, I'll just jump in quickly.
That's to you, Ken. Yeah.
This gets to, you know, the challenge of growth in this region, and I think we need not fall into the trap of thinking that moving this forward is going to be a panacea. I think that in communities such as Palo Alto or other communities that are transit served, where there is a walkable environment, part of the challenge is getting away from the notion that this is about numbers, that this is about density. We've done a lot of density at a sprawl level in this region. We have relatively dense suburbs, but they're not dense enough for people to really walk and meet their needs in their surrounding environment. We've got to move forward and change that. The numbers going forward are not so much the question, I think, as the placemaking qualities of these communities. And that's where it does get back down to the local level. The priority development areas that I mentioned earlier, you know, they run across a broad spectrum of places, from Cloverdale up in northern Sonoma County to the Transbay Terminal area here in San Francisco to Diridon Station down in San Jose. Each one of those places is quite different. The type of growth that should go forward in those areas is going to be different, and the quality of the place has to be different. That has to be done at the local level, but there has to be regional connectivity as well.
Yeah, go ahead, Will Fleischer.
I think it's really also important to point out that this opportunity is not about punishing anybody. Mm-hmm. What it's about is people stepping up to the plate and realizing that we have to change the patterns of living that we have been engaged in. And Palo Alto is a relatively privileged community in the region, and it really folks in Palo Alto and every region, every locality need to both protect the quality of life in their communities, but they also need to step up and join with other communities in promoting a pattern that's going to make the region healthy.
That email represents a kind of NIMBYism, though. You know, push it to Atherton. They're the more privileged community.
Exactly. But I think the point here is that we've discovered this in working with grassroots communities and most marginalized communities around the country. People are saying we are stepping up to the plate now. We understand that our neighborhoods are important, but we also have to make the region healthy. We have to make the region work in order for our whole society to work. And so every community needs to really understand how it is connected to the other ones so that it's not just about trying to push low-income housing into one place, but about making sure that we all take responsibility as well as potentially get the benefits of a greater level of collaboration and more synergy between all the different parts.
All right, now we're at it.
Well, Fleischer, we are. Yeah,
this is really the point. We've heard the one end of the spectrum, the regional policy, this is the right thing to do. And now we've heard the local perspective, which is very much about, it is about my neighborhood that I love and cherish. And we have to come up with a different way to frame this problem. And I think the opportunity that Carl has spoken to is if we stay in this old notion that it's about the region and these regional, somebody's making these decisions, and this notion that everybody is going to make their own decision for the local politique, we have to break that. And what I would like to suggest and hear what other people have to say is if we look at it as a corridor and we start to identify that where this is going to play out, where this plan is going to play out, is along a series of neighborhood stops and local districts. And we're not trying to jam anything into any one station. We're saying what can happen along a mile wide, actually, of these areas. How do we get the affordability? But maybe it doesn't all happen at one station and right at the station. Maybe you still have mobility because you have shuttle buses coming every 6 minutes in an area that isn't right at the station.
You want to change the configuration of thinking almost. But here's another response actually to what we're talking about here. As you say, we're into it here. Here's John who writes, so-called smart growth in the urban core has become the artful dodge and buzzword by opening established, settled, and historic neighborhoods to high-rise, quick-buck developers who really don't care about the established quality of life. Developers can knock down a low-rise historic building to replace it with fancy new high-rise, all in the name of density and transit orientation. Look what happened in the Mission in San Francisco. Cities allow out-of-place and out-of-scale high-rises in a historic neighborhood by calling it an infill project. All this high-rise development undermines the quality of existing parkland and open space as well, and your guests say the locals should be involved in the process, but the reality is that local governments and developers don't want to deal with these negative impacts. They just want their new projects.
So if I can jump in here, I think a few few of the things that have been said around this
table are
very key. The issue of placemaking or thinking about whether it's corridors or downtowns or whole communities, we need to be thinking in terms of what is it that we aspire to as communities, not what is it that – what's the medicine we have to take that's being prescribed
as, forgive me, interrelated communities, you're saying. Really.
Well, interrelated communities or even individual communities. And so – and we've seen in places – this is not theoretical. We've seen in places like Hercules. We've seen in places like San Leandro where there's been an active effort to engage people around what is going to happen on a relatively large scale for that place. That we've ended up with not the citizens coming out and saying we're opposed to this, but instead we want to see it happen. In Hercules, there was a plan done a few years ago that there's now folks pounding at the door of the city council saying, well, we want that housing and that retail that you said was going to come a while ago. And so I think there's a really key point, and Carl has made it, and I think everybody has made it around the table, that early public engagement that identifies what the wants and the needs of existing residents are is really key to making these places happen.
And that goes back to the predictability issue that I made earlier, which is if you do this kind of character and the sense of violence, actually, that the person who wrote in about these high rises and the Mission, et cetera, if we could, in this early plan, identify the character that we do want, and there are ways to do density. And I've done this in lectures where you show an audience and say, guess the number of the density.
You're on radio. You don't have your PowerPoint.
Right. But they get it wrong consistently. So the numbers and what it means in your brain and the image, we can add the kind of units in the mix. And what we haven't covered, and I'd like to at a subsequent discussion, is the demographics. And that's something that cuts across every situation in terms of whatever ethnic situation. The older, the younger population, the smaller families, the immigrant population who are desirous and are creating the demand for this close-in housing.
It's a very important part of the whole picture. I want to go to more callers here, but actually, Carl, I know you're about to speak here, but I've got actually an important email that I have to bring to your attention. It's Mark who says, if you had any real environmentalists on the panel, and I must say I've known Carl Anthony long enough that I think he fits that category, but this is what Mark says, they would be talking about how to protect the environment by stopping population growth, not how to mitigate the damages with meaningless buzzwords like sustainability and smart growth.
You know, I'm going to speak about one of the contributions of our book, Breakthrough Communities, and it's something that we discovered in looking at communities that were successful all over the country. And it's a tool that we have evolved, which is called the compass for transformative leadership. And that compass very often starts with neighborhoods and communities saying no. And it's really an important part of the process for people to say no, because by saying no, your voice really becomes important and you begin to understand what it is that you want to stop. But we discovered that the communities that are really successful, the breakthrough communities, have gone beyond that. They've gotten grounded in the new reality, they've reached for new horizons, and they've come to a place where they're also capable of saying yes. And I think what we're really talking about here is mobilizing communities and giving them the opportunity to really be clear about what it is that they really are opposed to, and also to have a process and a path by which they, standing together with their neighborhoods, with their communities, beginning to say, this is what we are for. Now, when people talk about low-income communities and whatnot, most of these people who are very wealthy or middle-class people, they go shopping like everybody else. And the people who work in those supermarkets, the cashiers need places to live, the teachers need places to live, the firefighters need places to live. All of these different folks who don't make $200,000 a year, some of whom are hanging by their fingernails, need places to live. And many of those people help to support the quality of life in very wealthy neighborhoods. So what we really need to do is to get to a new pattern where we understand our interdependence and begin to say, what is it going to take to make this region really serve everybody? And I think what is on the table here, what is the opportunity for all of us, all 7 million people, is to be able to challenge and change the pattern that we've inherited and make it better for everybody, including the new people who have not yet arrived.
All right. We've got a lot of new people who would like to talk here, and let's get many of our callers on as we can. Dwayne, good morning.
Good morning. Great show again. Hey, the question I've got, I live out in Fairfield, and in the Fairfield area, and frankly all of Solano County, there's tremendous historical pressure for doing fringe development. And in today's environment, with cities just absolutely struggling for the last dollar they can get their hands on, the pressure that they hear from the sprawl developer types of, you know, we'll provide you with building fees, just let us go out to the next 1,000 acres, is just endless. And it's very difficult, I think, for the local elected officials to resist. So I think part of what you guys are talking about today is a pattern that would have a little less of that kind of development out here on the edge, and more housing development in the closer in parts of the Bay Area. But how do we get the local folks here on the edge to say, well, you know, let's rethink our pattern of development also?
Well,
go ahead, Jeremy Mazin.
I was going to say, I think there's a few things. One, I want to actually acknowledge something that Will brought up earlier, is that we actually have changing demographics in this region and in this country. We have there's been a number of polls that have been done recently that say the population of the Bay Area wants just as much as they want a large home with a large yard. They want to be able to live close to jobs, close to transit, and they're willing to take a smaller home in a more urban setting. And so what we're talking about is not necessarily going against what developers or what the public wants, but it's how to actually supply for that demand. Now, out on the urban edge, we need to think about what makes quality of life in places like Solano County great. And I think part of what makes Solano County great is it is one of the most spectacular natural settings and agricultural settings that we have in California. And so we want to be working with those counties to maintain that quality and make Solano County something just as special for this region as, say, Napa County, and be really celebrating that landscape.
Ken Kirky, I want to go to you on this. Getting a number of emails about water concerns, and certainly they have to be factored into this.
Water concerns do. And one of the things that I wanted to touch on, Michael, was the comment earlier, because we hear this fairly often about, well, if we could just stop all growth, stop all population growth, the 2 million additional folks that are projected through the next 25 years, that's the birth rate being higher than the death rate by and large. That's not a forecast. It's based upon, you know, hundreds of thousands of people moving to this region. That's just that we're a growing region based upon the folks that are here now and how do we house those people going forward. Water is an important issue, and one of the challenges, again, not to pick on the state of California, but in California, is that water politics are tough. The focus initiative that we've spoken about earlier really brings together a lot of different interests. It brings together regional and local. It brings together nonprofits. It brings together AIR, the Bay Conservation Development Commission, et cetera. The water agencies and the provision of water is a key issue. And I think going forward, one of the things that we need to be looking at is how water is used based upon different types of development. if we can house more people in the Inner Bay Area in green but somewhat denser environments, rather than continuing to shift more and more of our population out to the Central Valley in areas that are essentially the Delta, we're going to use less water. We're going to have a more sustainable future on that front. And in terms of another item that was – another issue that was brought up, I just want to touch on the theoretical versus not theoretical approach of where we're at right now. At this point in time, there are 18 neighborhood-level plans funded by the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, supported by the regional agencies, in local communities. One's in Upper Broadway in Oakland, for example. These are the kinds of planning efforts that folks are talking about, where people from those communities will really have an opportunity to get involved in looking at what their neighborhood will be in the future and getting behind a plan that is something they can really embrace and can support in the future. And that's a different approach than we've had in this region in the past.
And we do need to look at the economics, as the caller mentioned, on the fringe development.
Will
it is about how you actually pay the full cost of building out in the out yonder, out in where the – in Brentwoods or in Antioch or in the areas where there still is that agriculture. I'd like to put out that this – we have to change the notion of what development means and come up with a new form called restorative development. And it's restorative in terms of the watersheds and creating better open spaces. It's about intergenerational mixed-income housing that we can address the demographics and some of the social equity issues at the same time. We have to look at how we're investing in our communities and in that infrastructure, and how can we also lower our carbon footprint and build more sustainably. It has to be tied together. And if we can find ways, we can increase the bottom line for the developers, but increase the social bottom line to the communities, and that's what we're trying to find, is a way to expand
in
that
pie. In a nearly
pie.
Broke state, though, as one of the listeners
we can do
points out in an email here, we have these ancient water lines and ancient sewer lines, and things have to be that are cracked have to be fixed, and you know the problems are legion. But let me get some more of our callers on here. Mark, join us.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm calling you from the beautiful Mission District of San Francisco, which is ground zero for a lot of these development proposals. The thinking is we're on a BART line, so we can build as high as we want to, and then everyone can get to work okay. But the issues of economics are really important. I'm in a low-income community here, and we've seen nothing but developers chomping at the bit to make a lot of money on the so-called TOD, transit-oriented development. But the transit lines don't exist to take you from workplace to your home over a work lifetime. What happens if you get a job in San Jose and the Caltrain works, but then you get a job in Brentwood or wherever, you know, another job site might be? That this doesn't work over time. And TOD without T is just OD.
I think the point that Will was making is really important, that we really have to begin to move to a totally different idea about development. And when you talk about restorative development, I think we really need to think about how does our transportation system serve the whole region effectively. And I wanted to just point out that we heard from a caller from the suburban fringe, and then we're talking to people in the inner city. We have grown accustomed to the idea of the interests of these people being separate. The jurisdictions are fighting one another over opportunities to get retail establishments that makes taxes work. But what we're really talking about here is a new collaborative engagement with the people who live in the suburban fringe, as well as those who live in the inner cities. So I think your point about transit being necessary and about us having an approach to this that's not just driven by private developers whose single interest is profit. Sure, people have a right to make a living, but we want to make sure that people are doing development that solves the main problems of our communities. And it's going to require changing the way in which we think about development, but it's also going to mean people living in the mission thinking about those who live out on the suburban fringe, and people who live in the suburban fringe understanding that every time you build a new school, every time you extend the infrastructure, you're not paying the full cost of that people in other communities are paying for that. So we really need to have a much more synergistic approach within the region as opposed to just simple neighborhood and localities.
And again, Carl Anthony is founder of Earth House. Along these lines, in terms of enmity against developers and maybe needing to reconceive development, Will Fleisig, here's a listener, Julia, who says, we don't just have a green belt. We also have some of the San Francisco Bay left as open space, but developers keep wanting to fill in more. Smart growth advocates like your guest should be saying no way to the massive 12,000-unit development now being pushed on salt ponds in Redwood City. It's not infill. It's bayfill, not transit-oriented, and would be inundated by sea level rise.
Look, we need to, while we're thinking about the nature of new kinds of development, we also have to change the way we're thinking about open space. And I think for Greenbelt, this is an opportunity to reframe their agenda and think about urban open lands, to talk about not just the open space that's out at the edge, but what is about the interconnected open spaces and small pocket parks and little recreation fields and how you move around all those pieces that we all enjoy when we do live in the Mission or in the middle of the city or in Berkeley, wherever it is. So I think it's a reframing of the open space and watershed discussion along with development. That's where we're going to find the intersection where people can start to come together and agree that if we increase the open spaces, even within the inner city, that that will be a positive benefit. Right. And let me just say this. I think
a lot of reframing going on.
There's a lot of reframing, but we also have to reframe on the local political level. Look, they set the rules. Let's be clear about this, that when someone's upset about the height of a building in the Mission, someone set that rule. And the someone who set that was a supervisor or a planning commissioner. And we have to give these people who do make the rules, set the rules, a new way to look at how to make sure that when a development's being proposed, it is addressing the community concerns that Carl has identified. It addresses the ecological concerns that Ken has identified. But it's also allowing for a way of designing and developing and showing people that this can be done in a way that, that doesn't feel like it's going to be a super high rise.
Looks like the developer gets the last word in here, but it's a word that represents at least a kind of consensus. And let me thank you all for being with us this hour. Again, Will Fleisig is president of Communitas Development, and Carl Anthony, founder of Earth House, Jeremy Madsen, executive director of Greenbelt Alliance, and Ken Kirky, planning director of the Association of Bay Area Governments. They can see the plan. Listeners can go to the website.
GrowSmartBayArea.org.
GrowSmartBayArea.org. Thank you all for a good hour. And thank you, our listeners. Wouldn't be here without you. Another hour coming up. We're going to talk about the peeping culture, all these social networks and tweeting and all that. Hour ahead. Join us. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.